This is Saul Stern. I am a contributing editor of City Journal. I have an essay about Professor E.D. Hirsch and his core knowledge program in the fall issue of City Journal, which is available now on our website. I'm sitting in the City Journal offices with Professor Hirsch. We've just come back from a scintillating lecture he's just given for Manhattan Institute at the Harvard Club. And we're going to be discussing some of his ideas, his education reform ideas, and also some of the background and how he came to become an education reformer in the mid-1980s. So the first question I have for Don, which is how his colleagues and friends refer to him, is to tell the listeners a little bit about how you made a transition and why you made a transition from being a very successful, widely admired professor of English at the University of Virginia, publishing widely in the scholarly journals, having published a number of very well-received scholarly books about English literature. And starting in around 1983, you became a crusading education reformer. What happened?
Well, Saul, I didn't realize it at the time, but there is a coherent line of thought that I now see between my early writings in English literature and on English and the interpretation of literature, which was the key topic I dealt with, and education reform, because what I discovered when I was challenging the new critical dominance of the day, where the text was the end-all and be-all, and you weren't supposed to go beyond the text in interpretation, there was a flaw in that view, and that was that you couldn't really decide on an interpretation if you just stuck to the text. To really understand, differentiate between theory A and theory B about what a text meant, you had to be able to bring in extrinsic knowledge, background knowledge, as the psychologists now call it. But that psychological work hadn't been so long ago. It was yet to take place. So come about 1978 or so, I discover that young college students can't read, they can't write very well, not because of their failures in formal technical linguistic matters, but because they didn't know enough to understand what they were reading, and they didn't know enough to communicate well with the general audience either. And so what I came to think was not only was New Criticism, as it were, wrong about the interpretation of literature, but that kind of formalism was wrong about education generally. The idea that all you needed to do was learn how to read a poem, or how to read a novel, or how to read a work of general nonfiction, that was not enough. You had to have a great deal of relevant background information, and that's what our schools were depriving students of, particularly disadvantaged students.
And as you once told me, you actually did an experiment that was published in a peer-reviewed psychology journal.
Yes.
You moved over, that was your first venture out of your right. Your academic cocoon.
Yes, my proudest publication was the...
Tell us about the experiment.
It was a technical article. It was, it had the title, I think, if I can remember it right, Assessing the Relative Readability of Prose. And anyway, the basic principle was that you couldn't assess how well written or badly written a piece of prose was as simply as a piece of prose. You had to take into account what the readers happened to know in order to figure out its true readability. And that experiment really, I guess, changed my life, because I discovered that community college students in Richmond, Virginia could read perfectly well in a technical way. But with a passage on Lee's Surrender to Grant, they really didn't know what it was all about. Whereas the UVA students, who were a sort of control group, could read both Why I Like My Roommate and Lee's Surrender to Grant. And so, but it wasn't a difference then in technical reading ability. It was whether they knew about the Civil War.
And what was the connection between that discovery and your theory of cultural literacy that in effect turned you into an education reformer focusing on the early grades of schooling, grades 1 to 5 and 6?
Well, it was a case in my view of being able to engage in a process of deductive reasoning from A to B to C to D. That is, if it turns out that you have to have background knowledge to understand a text, then if you turn around and think of the problem from the standpoint of the writer momentarily, well, my readers have to know certain things to understand what I am writing. Well, you put that to somebody who's writing for a newspaper or a wide circulation magazine, gee whiz, what does my audience know? And then you, that's the concept where the concept of cultural literacy comes from. You, the writer has to be able to project a certain range of background knowledge among the readers. And similarly, the readers have to have that background knowledge in order to understand what the writer has written down, because the text doesn't explain itself. You have to bring a lot of things to the text. I love the remark of Northrop Frye that a text is like a picnic. The author brings the words and the reader brings the meanings. And this is the problem. The reader can't bring the meanings unless they has the relevant background knowledge. So it turns out that in order to communicate in a newspaper or a magazine or write an article for the City Journal, you have to be able to project what it is that your readers will already know and can you can therefore take for granted. Well, that's what cultural literacy is. It's what the general run of educated people in a speech community do share in common, which enables them to understand writing. Understand not only writing, but understand the television, understand the radio, any kind of mass communication, or the internet, for that matter. Any sort of mass communication depends on that shared, unspoken knowledge. That was the insight. And as you say, it came from, or as I said, it came from the original insight that new critical theory was wrong. You need much more than the text. But if that's the case, you need much more than the text, then you also need to have some commonality of education if you want everybody to be literate.
And how did you get from that insight, to concluding that teachers, first grade, kindergarten, first grade, second grade teachers should consciously think through and think about cultural literacy in their classrooms? And did you see any obstacles in that, given the general, were you aware of the flack you would get from current theories of education?
No, I really was an innocent about what was going on. But the reason you have to start in kindergarten and first grade and even preschool is this horrifyingly unjust situation that I encountered in that experiment that you described, where the largely African-American students did not know about the Civil War and the largely middle-class white students at UVA did know about the Civil War. What had the schools of Richmond, Virginia been doing? That was, how is this possible that these kids now in community college don't know who Grant and Lee are? So I gradually came to discover, it took me several years, it was so surprising that basically these children did not know these things because they had not been taught these things. So how could you go to school and not really learn about the Civil War? And then you find out that all kinds of things that these children weren't learning about, which middle-class educated people took for granted. And yes, that's what started me. It was the injustice of that situation. And then I found out only later that the whole dominant, almost monopolistic view of education that was taught in schools and colleges of education was what I now call an anti-curriculum movement. You must not have a set curriculum. It's evil to have a set curriculum. So these knowledge was being withheld from these students on principle. And the way to solve the problem is to impart that knowledge systematically starting in those early grades. That's QED.
And when you said these things in your first education book, appropriately called Cultural Literacy, you shot almost to the top of the bestseller list. You were on the New York Times bestseller list for 26 weeks. Were you surprised? And who do you think read that? Obviously, you challenge the dominant ideology of the education establishment. So if teachers and the education people didn't read it, who was reading Cultural Literacy and propelled it to the top of the bestseller list? Was it parents?
Yes, parents. There were three categories. General interested people. I have to preface this by saying at that period when the book was becoming very notable, I would get thank you, effusive thank you letters in my mail at UVA in the morning. And I had this whole collection of gratified, usually older teachers in the schools who were saying, finally somebody has said this. And hate review in the technical journals and the teachers in the education journals. The Higher Ed Education Review was hysterical. Teachers College Bulletin was not only hysterical, it thought one bad review was not enough. They had to put two in the same issue, which Checker Finn tells me is a record. And generally, that has been the reaction of the education community, is that I'm the evil empire. And I now understand, it was puzzling to me at first, because what I was saying just made common sense, but I now understand that the main principle of the American education world is there must not be a set curriculum. If you have somebody who comes along saying there must be a set curriculum, it's obviously heresy, and heresy must be stamped out. That's why I was so vigorously attacked.
You were also attacked because at that period you were linked with the terrible killer bees, Bloom, Bennett, and Bellow. And in fact, Bloom's book was also on the bestseller list. How did you feel about it? All those, the three are basically thought of as conservatives.
Yeah.
And you're not a conservative. What was your reaction when you were, in effect, called some sort of reactionary?
So my reaction was disappointment. And it, I have to say, that's been the key emotion of most of my work in the education field, because one way or another I've been repudiated by both the left and the right, and it's, you know, it's never comfortable to be attacked by everybody. Well, that doesn't mean that people in the middle haven't been allies. There have been some very valuable allies, including yourself, notably you most recently, who have picked up this cause. But the reaction of being paired with Alan Bloom and Saul Bellow is a different issue, and Bill Bennett, but Bloom and Bennett was, I said, oh dear, they don't understand. And that has been the problem, is that there has been what I call premature ideology in the whole sphere of education. If you're for phonics, you must be a Republican. You know, if you're for a definite curriculum, you must be right wing. And of course, if you're against a definite curriculum, you must be a right-thinking liberal. And the paradox, of course, is that if you're a right-thinking liberal who is against a definite curriculum, then what happens is you are a great perpetuator of social injustice, because the withholding of a definite curriculum is the greatest cause of educational injustice, I think, and continues to be in the country.
But this may be a little esoteric for our listeners, but I'll bring it up anyway. One of the ironies is that one of your education heroes is Antonio Gramsci, the founder of the Italian Communist Party, who did most of his writings in jail, where he was placed by Mussolini. Now, how did that come about? What is it about Gramsci that attracted you and his approach to particularly mass education?
Well, one flippant response would be, great minds think alike. I mean, what Gramsci saw was that what poor kids need is mastery of the dominant culture. And that was the only way they could grasp the levers of power, or what did you call it, a counter-hegemony. That was the only way they would be able to manage. And that was one of the themes of cultural literacy, is you have to master these tools, these cultural tools, if you want to get anywhere, either economically or politically. And Gramsci recognized that clearly. He was in favor of essentially the common school, a single type of formative school is what he called it in the Italian. And that was nothing other than what the founding fathers had in fact envisaged as being necessary if the people were going to grasp the levers of power in a republic. So Gramsci was really just a good democratic school theorist, quite apart from his political views. And he was fighting in those days the progressivists. And the guy who was, I'm going to block the name of his philosophical rival, Croce. Croce's, it wasn't Croce, it was Croce's friend whose name I'm continuing to block.
Well, in any event, wasn't Dewey a rival, in effect?
It was an Italian version of Dewey, yes. who was then Minister of Education under Mussolini, who said, oh, no, we're going to do projects. And so, it's marvelous to see that. And, of course, it's very disorienting. And people don't read Gramsci here, but in Europe, Gramsci's a very important name. And it's very disconcerting to have this connection. But it is esoteric, but it's quite delicious in a way.
Well, it links to something that's more germane, and that is, unfortunately, I think you would agree, that the education schools actually now worship a very different kind of Marxist, Paulo Freire, a Brazilian revolutionary Marxist, who is the number one bestseller in the education schools that you mentioned, and I checked it myself, and today, on Amazon, number one bestseller in education books is Gramsci, is Freire. You're somewhere around the double digits. I won't go into. And to me, that's the great tragedy because, in my view, Freire is the worst in education, the worst education idea, and you have the best education idea. So, and what is the impact of actually? Do you think the fact that Freire, basically, his text is probably the number one text in foundations of education courses in the ed schools.
Well, Freire is doubly attractive because on the one hand, he has the aura of good liberation, social justice, political impulses that a lot of educators, including me, have. The idea that you gain greater social justice through education is a basic American idea, but certainly a strong idea. So that's very agreeable. At the same time, Freire is saying, oh, no, we must not have the banking theory of education, which is that you actually are teaching kids the dominant culture. And there he's parting ways with his supposed master, Gramsci, completely. I mean, Gramsci said, no, you have to master these received materials. You're not going to replace them. The idea that you're going to replace whole cloth, the English language and its associated traditional knowledge that's recorded in books in the library and has gone on for hundreds of years, is a total mirage. And so if you really have progressive political leanings, you better be an educational conservative.
And I see we're running out of time. And so my last question is that your current book, The Making of Americans, which in my humble opinion is your most important book, you go back to another canonical authority. You go back 200 years to the Founding Fathers. If you could just talk about that, why go back? What's the relevance on these issues that we've just discussed? What do teachers teach in a classroom? What do American kids have to learn? What's the relevance of the Founding Fathers?
Well, I think there were two reasons the Founding Fathers thought the common school was so important, two basic ones. There's a third that's also very important. One was that in order to govern ourselves, we had to have shared knowledge. Everybody had to be able to make reasonable decisions if the people were to rule. But the second important reason, equally important for most of them, was they also had to share a commitment to the Union, to the Republic, because all these local states and factions and special interests would otherwise take over, as they always had, and this was a piece of historical knowledge that they shared. Always in the past, republics had collapsed because of these special interests and factions. So that double reason, and it was a third that Jefferson in particular had, and that was we ought to give everybody a chance. So there were these three reasons for the common school, and it hasn't changed. I think basically that is the basic set of ambitions for American schooling. We need to get back to it, which I call the community-centered school, and we need to abandon the so-called child-centered school and its anti-curriculum idea.
Well, going back to Thomas Jefferson is a great way to end this conversation, and lucky you, you're still at the University of Virginia, which is where the spirit of Thomas Jefferson is very much present, and I hope you enjoy your trip back to Charlottesville.
This was fun. Thanks.